What I want to do today is talk a little bit about or show you a video, a half-hour video on geologic time. And it gives you an idea of how geologists look at rocks and begin to figure out their ages, whether it's one age of a rock relative to the age of another rock, relative time dating, or absolute time dating, where we use other techniques to figure out the actual age of formation of the rock. Now, this is kind of a background kind of thing, because one of the things I want to do is once that's done, I'll pull the screen up, and then I'm going to kind of ask you to come around a little bit closer to the front a little bit, and I'll just show you a couple kinds of principles that geologists use in looking at rocks and kind of how we categorize rocks and what do those categories tell us. And then if we've got time, we'll try to put that stuff together and just take a look at a geologic map of the area. And I know that you're not going to come out of this thing knowing how necessarily to read a geologic map. That's not my purpose. But just to give you a flavor or a feel for how geologists would look at the rocks in this area to answer questions about, like, how would you mine that deposit, for example, and that kind of thing. You need to get a feel for how geologists kind of work, and that's what I'm going to try to do today, is give you that feel. I wanted to start out with the concept of geologic time, because it's one of the very central parts of geology. Some very fascinating, complicated things happen when we think about the evolution of the Earth, and we think about, well, how could that possibly take place? I mean, if the continents are moving apart at a rate of, say, a couple inches per year or something of that nature, why? You can't see that. I mean, how can that possibly be very important? Well, when you begin to put the layer of geologic time on top of all that, even processes which are very, very slow can accomplish many wondrous kinds of things, because you have so much time. When the Earth is 4.6 billion years in age, you can cover a lot of sins in 4.6 billion years. You can do a lot of things. I do have copies of a geologic time scale with me, and I'll hand those out after the video. And you can just take those, and it gives you an idea of how geologists break geologic time up into various groups, and how we name them, and what we mean when we say the age of the mammals, how far back does the age of the mammals go, and the age of the dinosaurs, and that kind of thing. We'll give you some of that information as well. So I'm going to start the video, and we'll watch that, and then we'll turn that off, and then I'll go to the board behind there and see if we can't figure out how geologists do this kind of work.
More than 300 years ago in Ireland, Archbishop Usher calculated the age of Earth based on the Book of Genesis. He determined that our planet was created 4,004 years before the birth of Christ, on the 26th of October, at 9 o'clock in the morning. Widely praised by scholars and theologians, Usher's calculation was not seriously challenged in the Western world for almost a century. Today, scientific evidence indicates that Earth is much older than biblical text suggests. By counting growth rings, botanists have found trees as much as 8,000 years old. And with the development of radioactive age dating, geologists have concluded that our planet came into being not thousands, but billions of years ago.
Thank you. Humorist Mark Twain once remarked, "Nothing hurries geology." He was referring, of course, to the almost imperceptible geologic change that one sees in a human lifetime. No aspect of this science is more difficult for most people to grasp than the concept of geologic time. Our lives are governed by events that are measured by clocks, in seconds or minutes or hours. At most, we may plan months or years in advance. But to understand the nature of Earth, we need to stretch our concept of time beyond our human experience and into a geologic frame of reference. Events in Earth history, such as the development of mountain ranges, the ripping apart of continents, and the creation of new ocean basins, have been repeated over and over. And each of these geologic events takes place over many millions of years. The estimated age of Earth itself is over 4.6 billion years, an incomprehensibly vast period of time. One way to illustrate the immense panorama of geologic time is to draw an analogy using a time period that we can easily relate to. So let's condense the entire age of the Earth into one calendar year. On this scale, the Earth and its neighboring planets were formed on January 1st. By sometime in early March, the planet had cooled sufficiently to allow water to stand in pools on its surface. The very earliest forms of life appeared by late March, and oxygen gas became an important part of Earth's atmosphere beginning sometime in late July. Multicellular organisms appeared by October 25th, but it was not until late November that plants and animals were abundant on land. On about December 15th, the dinosaurs appeared, but disappeared in a sudden mass extinction on December 25th. The first humans appeared at about 11:20 p.m. on December 31st, and the Industrial Revolution began less than a second and a half before midnight. The first person to realize the immensity of geologic time and begin to investigate it in a systematic way was an 18th century Scotsman named James Hutton. His observations and ideas about the origin of rocks began as a pastime that he shared with other wealthy intellectuals of Edinburgh society. But Hutton's interpretations and conclusions ignited a major controversy throughout Europe and survive today as the foundation for modern geologic thought.
James Hutton was born in Edinburgh, Scotland in 1726. Like most intellectuals of his time, he explored many disciplines, from law and medicine to chemistry and agriculture. And it was this last pursuit that was to lead him into the field of geology.
He had been left a little piece of land, and he decided to become a farmer. So he went to Norfolk, England, and lived with a farmer for a couple of years to learn how to farm, and farmed for 15 years. But while he was farming, and all of his neighbors believed that he was a perfectly good farmer, he was spending a great deal of his time looking and becoming more and more fascinated with the land, what was under the soil that he was tilling.
An important question intrigued Hutton. He saw that land is worn down in many places by the destructive forces of erosion. How then was it possible any land was left to support life? He believed there must be an undiscovered force building up the land, which counteracts the processes wearing it away. He began searching for evidence of this force, and soon found it. Hutton observed that streams washed sand and gravel into the sea, where this sediment accumulated in offshore deposits. He found similar material in the form of ancient sedimentary strata, tilted and raised above sea level. Surely, Hutton thought, these layers must also have formed underwater, then risen to become new land. Hutton also described a type of geologic structure called an unconformity, in which one group of layers is truncated by another. He reasoned that unconformities form when strata are tilted, uplifted, and eroded, then buried by younger successions of strata. The presence of unconformities in many outcrops indicated to Hutton that the land was molded by repeated cycles of uplift and erosion. this idea was in profound conflict with the biblical view, which held that the land had been created all at once. Of Earth history, James Hutton wrote, "We find no vestige of a beginning, no prospect of an end." Hutton was the first scientist to show that the world must be far older than most people believed.
One of the most astonishing things to him, and one of the most important elements of his work, was to try to establish that in fact geologic time was a very long period rather than the biblical creation time by Archbishop Usher sometime later in 4004 BC. But Hutton was convinced that geologic time was very extensive.
Hutton reasoned that if it takes about a year for a river to deposit a millimeter thick layer of sediment on the sea floor, then it must take at least a million years to lay down the 1,000 meter thick sequences of sedimentary rock that he had observed in some parts of Scotland. Many church authorities were stunned by Hutton's research, and not only because he claimed the world is much older than the Bible implied. Hutton also showed that supernatural events like the biblical flood aren't needed to explain why the world's surface looks the way it does. Ordinary processes seen every day could produce the same landscape given enough time. Hutton concluded that these processes have operated in the same manner throughout Earth's history. This idea became known as the theory of uniformity, or later as uniformitarianism. The principle of uniformity underlies modern geology. For example, the presence of vast amounts of layered rock in the Grand Canyon can be explained as the result of ordinary sedimentation operating over millions of years. Such vast spans of history have been distinguished from more modest everyday experience by a special designation, geologic time.
Although arguments about the age of the Earth raged among the intellectual community throughout the 19th century, most scientists had accepted the premise that the Earth must be millions of years old instead of just a few thousand. And although they were not yet able to measure the age of rocks, geologists realized they could determine the sequence of events in Earth history by combining careful observation with some simple logic. They first reasoned that any layered sequence of rocks is formed with the oldest layer at the bottom and successively younger layers on top. This principle, called superposition, allows us to place rock units in a historic sequence according to their relative age. They also observed that layered rocks, such as lava flows, volcanic ash layers, and sedimentary rocks, are deposited under the influence of gravity. For this reason, the rock layers themselves are horizontal. According to this principle, known as original horizontality, rock layers that are folded or tilted must have been tectonically deformed, and this had to have happened after they were deposited. And finally, any geologic feature that cuts across or truncates a group of rocks has to be younger than the rocks that are cut. So features such as faults, intrusions of molten rock, and erosional surfaces can also be placed in a relative age sequence using this principle, called cross-cutting relationships. Although these geologic principles are based on nothing more than common sense, they are absolutely fundamental to the interpretation of Earth history.
According to the principle of original horizontality, beds of sediment form as horizontal layers as the sediment settles under the force of gravity. The principle of superposition maintains that the oldest layers of undeformed sedimentary strata are on the bottom and the youngest on top. Finally, the principle of cross-cutting relationships states that a rock is younger than any rocks it cuts across. As in the case of veins of igneous rock cutting across strata, or of unconformities, such as Hutton studied.
The principles of relative age dating are simple and yet so powerful that they were used by early geologists in the 18th and 19th centuries to construct a complete historic sequence of all of the rocks in Europe. And because rock formations in a sequence like this often extend over a large area, they can be used to correlate rocks from one sequence with historically equivalent strata in other regions. This is easy to see in a place like the Grand Canyon. This formation, the Kaibab limestone, can clearly be recognized in the sequence of sedimentary rocks on the opposite side of the canyon. And because it's the same formation, it marks the same period of geologic time in both places. Some rock layers persist laterally for thousands of kilometers and can be recognized in different places by their thickness, mineral composition, and other characteristics. For example, volcanic ash from the 1980 eruption of Mount St. Helens has been identified in sedimentary sequences as far away as Minnesota and Arizona. Rock formations can be valuable time markers, but correlation is difficult over great distances because physical continuity and rock characteristics can be ambiguous. Fossils, like these shells of marine organisms, can be extremely valuable time markers. Each fossil species has its own lifespan, and rocks that contain fossils with overlapping lifespans are actual time markers that can be recognized wherever they are found. The use of fossils in making geologic time correlations was first discovered in the 15th century, and by the beginning of this century, geologists had used correlation to extend the historic rock sequence from Europe to every continent on Earth.
The word fossil refers to any evidence of a prehistoric plant or animal that has been preserved in rock. Sometimes, part of the organism itself remains intact. In some instances, recrystallized or petrified, like the trees in a petrified forest. In other cases, the organism may have been completely dissolved, leaving only a hollow mold of its own image. Throughout geologic time, fossil species succeed each other in a distinct, recognizable order. In general, progressively older fossils are increasingly different from life forms today. This observation came to be known as the principle of faunal succession, one of the strongest lines of evidence supporting Darwin's theory of evolution. The 19th and early 20th centuries were the heyday of the amateur paleontologist, or student of old life. These fossil hunters, combing the cliff faces and quarries of the globe, identified thousands of fossil species and painstakingly established their relative ages from the positions of the rock layers in which the fossils were entombed. Regardless of where on Earth fossils are found, they always occur in the same sequence relative to one another. Some of the lower rock strata in the Grand Canyon contain fossils of the same general groupings as those in certain very ancient rock layers found in Wales. Since the ancient name for Wales is Cambria, these rocks were called Cambrian rocks. And the geologic period in which they were formed, the Cambrian period. 19th century geologists used the names of places and ancient peoples to label other times in geologic history as well. For example, the Ordovician period, the Silurian period, and the Devonian period after Devon in southern England. Characteristic rocks and relative positions of strata were also used to designate new time units. And gradually, the geologic time scale was constructed.
The standard geologic time scale is based really on the law of superposition. The oldest rocks are on the bottom, the youngest rocks on the top. Looking at rocks in various parts of Western Europe, it was recognized that certain formations could be correlated from one region to another, and the older rocks were very distinctive with a distinct group of fossils in them. The younger rocks overlay the older ones. They had different colors, different characteristics, different fossils. By arranging them sequentially, which ones were the oldest and which ones were the youngest, they were able to establish a chronology just on the basis of superposition. Each of the rock units took a name from the organisms that were in it or the region where it was first studied, giving us the modern geologic timescale.
The relative age relationships that we see in rocks allow us to recognize geologic events in a historic sequence through time. But knowing only the order of events is a bit unsatisfying. Without the ability to measure the absolute age of these rocks, it's impossible to fully understand Earth history. And without a calibration of geologic time, we can't study the rates of geologic change that are used to make forecasts about future events. Scientific discovery is often born of chance events coupled with keen perception. In the late 19th century, Madame Marie Curie discovered that when certain types of rocks were stored in the same drawer overnight with undeveloped photographic film, the film was exposed. This chance event led to the discovery of radioactivity. In this process, certain types of atoms spontaneously disintegrate or decay. The decay is random, but it proceeds at a constant rate through time for each particular type of atom or isotope. Because many different types of rocks contain radioactive isotopes, Ernest Rutherford reasoned in 1905 that the uniform rate of radioactive decay could be used to measure geologic time. From this realization came the eventual development of techniques to measure the absolute age of geologic materials. Now, for example, not only do we know that the dinosaurs disappeared in a global mass extinction, we know it happened 64 million years ago.
Each element can be separated into isotopes, groups of atoms with similar atomic structure, though slightly different mass. Some isotopes are radioactive and therefore unstable. This instability causes the atoms to radiate energy, much of it in the form of electrically charged particles. The radiation gradually causes the element to disintegrate or decay, transforming the original radioactive isotope or parent into a stable isotope known as a daughter product. It is this process of decay that we call radioactivity. Grains of sand trickling through the narrow opening of an hourglass are somewhat analogous to isotopes decaying in a radioactive element. The sand in the upper half of the hourglass represents a supply of parent isotope. The sand in the lower half is its daughter product. The proportion of parent to daughter depends upon how much time has elapsed. This can be determined simply by measuring the ratio of parent to daughter sand. This is how radioactive dating works. The most familiar example is radiocarbon dating. The carbon in air and water is made up of three different isotopes. One of these, carbon-14, is radioactive. As part of the atmosphere, carbon-14 is absorbed by living plants and animals. In this way, the carbon in all living organisms contains the same proportion of carbon-14 to non-radioactive carbon. When the organism dies, it stops taking in any new carbon, and the amount of carbon-14 inside it gradually decreases as it decays. It is this shrinking proportion of carbon-14 that tells us how long ago the organism died. The rate of decay of any radioisotope is measured in terms of its half-life, how long it takes for half of its atoms to decay. The half-life of carbon-14 is 5,730 years. Carbon-14 is most commonly preserved in the form of charred wood that is buried by sediment, lava, or volcanic ash. If a sample contains only half the level of carbon-14 found in living organisms, geologists conclude that it must be 5,730 years old. If the ratio of carbon-14 is only a quarter of that of a living organism, another half-life has elapsed, and it must be 11,460 years old, and so on. This method is only reliable for dating things back about 50,000 years. Beyond that, the amount of radiocarbon remaining is too small to permit accurate measurement. To date rocks that are millions or even billions of years old, geologists work with radioisotopes that take much longer to decay, such as uranium-235. This element makes an excellent geologic clock because it takes 713 million years for half of it to decay into lead-207. By measuring the relative amounts of these two isotopes in a rock, it's possible to figure out the rock's age, even if it is several billion years old.
The first step in determining the age of the rock is finding the proper rock in the field and determining its mineralogy. Once we've determined what it is we want to date, then we sample it in the field, bring it back into the laboratory, separate out the minerals that we want to date that tell us the age of the rock. Once we have a clean mineral separate, then we take it into the laboratory and we separate out chemically the elements that are within the rock that have the isotopic system that we're interested in. And then once we have the elements separated, we bring the elements into the mass spectrometer, and with the mass spectrometer, we analyze the isotopes of the elements that we're interested in. And if the isotopic ratios between the parent and the daughter isotopes, and between the various daughter isotopes, they give us the age of the rock.
The mass spectrometer accelerates the ions, or charged atoms, of an element so that they form a beam, which is then spread out into a succession of points, a mass spectrum. From the position and intensity of the points, the mass and relative abundance of individual isotopes can be determined.
Once the element that we're going to measure is loaded in the mass spectrometer, it's ionized at a temperature between 1,000 and 2,000 degrees centigrade, depending on what element it is. The ions are then accelerated by 8 to 10,000 volt drop down the tube, which is a high vacuum tube. And as they're being accelerated, they're focused into a very fine beam. Once they enter the tube as a fine beam, they move through a magnetic field. The magnetic field puts a drag on the ion beam, which causes the heavy isotopes to bend along the outer part of the tube and the lighter ones into the inner part of the tube. By the time the beam comes out of the magnetic part of the tube, it's broken into its various isotopes, and at the far end of the tube, we count the ions of each isotope, which ultimately gives us our isotopic ratio.
The complete process of collecting rock samples, preparing them for analysis, and doing the mass spectrometry requires a great deal of time and skill.
Then you finally get to the point where you put the final bit of data into your computer and calculate your age. And at that point, it all comes to somewhat of a crescendo, and you get very excited, and there it is, finally you have your results. And sometimes you're totally surprised, sometimes you're disappointed, and sometimes you're elated with your results. And then the final, of course, aspect of it is really applying the age data to your actual geological relations.
Minerals which contain radioactive isotopes act like tiny clocks inside of rocks, clocks which are reset when a rock is formed or metamorphosed. Before geologists learned to measure the absolute ages of rocks using radioactive isotopes, they could only establish relative ages using the common sense logic of superposition, original horizontality, and cross-cutting relationships. They knew that one rock formed before another, but never how old the rocks actually were. The reliability and accuracy of radiometric age dating is truly impressive. The results of over half a century of radiometric age dating studies are entirely consistent with the relative age relationships developed by early geologists. So the science of geology has given us two ways to understand Earth history. First, we determine the relative age of rock formations and geologic structures, and then use these ages to construct a historic sequence of events through time. Then, by applying radiometric age dating techniques, we determine the absolute timing of these events and measure the rates of geologic change as well. So not only does our study of geologic time allow us to understand Earth's past, it gives us a historic framework and the tools for predicting the planet's future.
Somebody turn on the lights over there.
We might try brightening this up a little bit.
Well, it's an interesting video. There are a couple of errors in it, but nothing that you would necessarily notice. Kind of funny, you know that shot in the Grand Canyon where Dr. Sad is saying that we're right standing right by the Kaibab limestone, and then they show that shot going across the Grand Canyon, and they show the arrows coming down and pointing out that light colored layer. They're actually pointing out the wrong layer when they do that. They're actually pointing out a rock that's known as the Coconino sandstone. And not that it matters, but it's just kind of interesting.
We didn't even care.
When they did the radiometric age dating, the carbon 14, when they showed those ratios, 1/2, 1/4, 1/8, 1/16, when they did 1/2, that was correct. When they did 1/4, that was correct. And when they did 1/8, and then 1/16, they had the wrong dates. You have to be wise. They're just kind of curious. It doesn't matter. The principles are the same. Now, if you wish, I have a copy of the geologic time scale, and you might want to take a copy with you and just take a look at it. I mean, not that it's the kind of thing that's going to redefine your life, but kind of interesting stuff. And the terminology is kind of interesting. You get an idea of the ages of the rocks that we're using. Now, I've got a little bit of time. I've got about 20 minutes, and you're so far away. I'm just wondering if you would be willing to move up a little bit. I want to just talk a little bit about some of this stuff, and
here you go.
Because I'm
close.
That's fine. You just right up in here. Get as close as you can. I'm not afraid of you. And it would be so much easier for you to see some of this. Now, I know I'm going to be asking you to move around a little bit, so I'm going to take a look at that geologic map behind you. But take a look at that. I just want to point out, it's a great thing to think about geologic time. I
mean,
like I say, it covers a multitude of sins. When we can talk about billions of years of geologic history, you don't have to do things very fast. I just want to point out a few things about how geologists look at rocks, okay, in general. And the first thing I want to just point out is that geologists talk about a rock cycle, okay?
You may know, but there are three major groups of rock: igneous rocks, sedimentary rocks, and metamorphic rocks. Now, igneous rocks are those rocks which have formed from the cooling of very hot material. If you think about a volcano and you think about the magma coming out, or lava coming out of a volcano, when that cools into a rock, at the volcanic rock, that's an igneous rock. Now, that's cooled right at the Earth's surface, cooled very rapidly. Sometimes molten material is down deep in the Earth's crust, and it is molten at that point, and then it gradually cools over tens of millions of years, and it forms a rock within the Earth's crust, and that's also an igneous rock, because it formed from molten material, cooled, hardened, became a rock. It's called igneous rock. Now, so if we'll start there, let's just start here. Igneous rock means fire form, is what it means. If you erode that rock, if you've got a piece of granite, that's an igneous rock, and you have it out in the weather and the rain falls on it for centuries and centuries and centuries, and you gradually erode that rock and break it down into little pieces, you're eroding the rock and you're making what could potentially become a sedimentary rock, which is a rock which is made up of the pieces of other rocks, okay? If you take that same igneous rock and subject it to very high temperatures and pressures, say like down deep, back down within the Earth's crust, you can metamorphose it or change it. What you're doing is changing the nature of those crystals or those minerals that are a part of that igneous rock. Sometimes you're changing their shapes, sometimes you're changing their chemistry altogether and changing into different minerals. Well, the idea I just wanted to point out here is that this works in a big circle. You can take metamorphic rocks that might be formed right up here in Copper Mountain, let's say, or metamorphic rocks up there. If you were to bury those many tens of kilometers back down in the earth, where they would be subjected to high pressures and temperatures, those metamorphic rocks could be melted again and come go back into a magma. You could actually melt them, and then if you saw them again, they hardened and came back to this near the Earth's surface where we could see them, they would be what we would call igneous rock. You would never know necessarily that they were metamorphic at one time. So the point I just want to make here is that this idea of breaking rocks down into either igneous rocks or sedimentary rocks or metamorphic rocks implies there's a cycle to all of this. When we think about sedimentary rocks, by the way, being maybe made up of pieces of metamorphic rocks or pieces of igneous rocks or actually pieces of other sedimentary rocks, you can see why that if you get an age date, that radiometric age dating which he was talking about at the very end, if you find a mineral that you can date in there, what is that date telling you? It's telling you the age of that mineral, not telling you the age of that sedimentary rock, because that sedimentary rock is made up of pieces of a whole bunch of rocks. So you got to know what you're looking at when we talk about all this age dating stuff. And I just wanted to point out that there is a cycle to all of this.
What's the oldest sedimentary rock we have?
Gosh, good question. The oldest sedimentary rock that I know of?
See?
There are some relatively unmetamorphosed sedimentary rocks that are roughly a little over a billion years in age, that have not been subjected to metamorphism, have not been remelted or anything of that nature, which are still sedimentary rocks. Now, those are the oldest ones I know. There may be others that are older than that, but about a billion years in age. In Wisconsin, we have some that are about that age. The oldest rock in North America that's been dated is somewhere around a little over 3 billion sedimentary rock. That's a
actually a metamorphic. Actually, it is an igneous rock over in Minnesota. And
that's about the oldest
rock I know of in North America. About the oldest dated rock that we have record of is about 3.6 billion years. And the age of the Earth, we think now is somewhere around 4.6 billion. So anyway, the rock cycle, okay? I just wanted to point that out. And then all this other gobbledygook that is kind of hard to see from back there, but you might be able to see here. You can come up and look at this later if you're so inclined too. But I just wanted to point out a couple of things. When you have molten material deep in the Earth's crust and rocks, and that starts to cool, different minerals will become stable and will solidify, come out of that molten material. And they'll come out in a particular order, okay? What that means is that some minerals are stable at higher temperatures than other minerals, all right? And so over a period of time and observations and laboratory experiments and stuff, we put together a kind of order in which minerals form out of molten material, okay? And so, and I don't know if I'm blocking your view or not, but if you look at this order of minerals, if you look at minerals which are commonly found in igneous rock, we can see that certain minerals that are like, this is called olivine, which is like a magnesium silicate. And I'm not gonna give you all that compositional stuff because it's not that important. But the point is that this mineral, olivine, is stable at very high temperatures. So when that molten material, that everything's all melted, starts to cool, one of the first minerals that'll form will be olivine, assuming that they have all the right chemicals present, magnesium and silica and oxygen. And so we have, geologists have over time noted that there is a kind of order to which things will precipitate out of molten material. And what we'll see is that olivines, for example, as it continues, as this magma continues to cool, what will happen, we'll see evidence that some of that olivine is being resorbed. It becomes unstable, and what becomes stable is a mineral group known as pyroxenes. And we'll see pyroxenes form. Sometimes you'll see olivines and pyroxenes are the same rock. It's a very common thing to see those things together. And the olivines look a little funny, like they've been partially resorbed. The pyroxenes may look really crisp and sharp looking, very what we call euhedral crystals sometimes. I mean, you get a sense that there's an order to this and a way of predicting something about what the temperatures were then when these rocks were formed. So when you see rocks that have a certain assemblage of minerals in them, that tells you something about the temperature at which they formed, solidified, and became cool, and also the nature of the magma out of which they formed. And I won't go into a whole lot of detail here, but just to give you a feeling that there is an order to this, there's a sense to this when we look at that. Now, let me just direct your attention down here to this quadrant here. Another way of looking at igneous rocks is to talk about them. As you know, a rock is made up of an assemblage of minerals. It's not just one mineral. There are some rocks that are just one mineral, but most rocks are an assemblage of minerals. And so we've been able to divide. Geologists are great classifiers. They like to classify everything. Everything's got a name. You can put it into a pigeonhole, and there you've got it. Well, it's also what gets geologists into a lot of trouble because they end up arguing over the classification of things and whether they think it's one thing or another thing. And to most people, who cares what some of these things are? But to geologists, it's important to try to figure out how these things fit together. And one of the ways we do this is by classifying different things. So we classify igneous rocks into what we call felsic, intermediate, or mafic. Now, just the way to think about this is mafic is magnesium, magnesium and iron. Rocks that tend to be more enriched in iron and magnesium, we call mafic igneous rocks. The minerals that are in those kind of rocks tend to have more iron and magnesium in them. We see things like olivines and pyroxenes and hornblendes. Those are common kinds of minerals in those kind of rocks. Now, there are other minerals that are part of that, but these tend to be higher in iron and magnesium, and they form most of the minerals we find in mafic rocks. Felsic rocks tend to be more enriched in quartz. So when you pick up a piece of true granite, if you look at a granite, you can see the quartz that's in it. And sometimes you can see other kinds of rocks like orthoclase, which is a potassium feldspar, and other kinds of minerals, which suggest that it's formed at somewhat lower temperatures, and as opposed to the high iron and magnesium rich ones. But so we can break these things up, and then we have rocks in between. Okay, now to further confuse this a little bit, okay, now just before we get into what I was just about ready to go into, let me just explain it. So if you look at felsic rocks, like a granite, that may have maybe as much as 25% quartz in it. And it may have 75% feldspar, a particular potassium feldspar in it. And the composition of granites will vary. Different granites will have different amount of quartz, different amount of feldspar. There'll even be some iron magnesium, what are called ferromagnesian minerals in them, like some of these, biotites, hornblendes. Those kind of iron and magnesium bearing minerals could be a part of that. And so what we see is that as the relative proportions of these minerals change, you're getting different groups of rocks. Okay? Again, geologists like to classify things, and so this is a kind of a classification scheme. Okay. Now, what it begins to suggest is geologic history. Where these rocks might have come from, where were they when they formed? Were they deep down within the Earth's crust? Were they shallow in the Earth's crust? Were they near the surface, whatever? And so you begin to be able to piece together geologic history by looking at the composition of these rocks. Now I'm just talking a little bit about igneous rocks here. Sedimentary rocks, particularly rocks which are made up of pieces of other rocks, generally, we classify them on the basis of the size of those little particles. Now, this is not entirely always the case, but sometimes we do. There's a way of doing this. Sometimes we also group them according to what kinds of things are composing the rock. But just for sake of being simple about it, if you have a rock in which the individual pieces are greater than 2 millimeters in size. If it's not cemented together, we call those gravel. If it's cemented together, we might call it a conglomerate, and this kind of thing. These are terms you've all heard of, conglomerate or sandstone or siltstone or shale. And that relates to the size of the particles. There's a whole group of sedimentary rocks which have nothing to do with sizes, but they may be like limestone, which are precipitated maybe out of the ocean. They're not made up of pieces of other rock. They precipitated or formed in another way, and are actual chemical sedimentary rocks. When we metamorphose rocks, subject them to pressures and temperatures, we can get different kinds of mineral assemblages that reflect different temperatures and pressures of which rocks are subjected. Now let's just look at this diagram here for just a second. On this axis, I plotted the depth from the surface of the Earth down in towards, going down into the deep parts of the crust, down over 30 kilometers in depth. So the idea is that this is under increasing pressure. The weight of the rocks is getting greater and greater the deeper you go into the Earth. You have higher and higher pressures at depth. Okay, just simply become the weight of the rock. It's called lithostatic pressure. So you can imagine if you were carrying 100 pounds of rock on your shoulders, what that would feel like, and then now all of a sudden you're carrying 200 pounds of rocks on your shoulders and the pressure is just getting greater. The same way, if you get deeper into the Earth, there's more and more rock above at any particular point, gets higher and higher pressure. Also, when we go deep in the Earth sometimes, we also get higher temperatures go in well into the Earth. And eventually, if you reach high enough temperatures, you can melt the rock. Okay. And now what I've shown on this diagram is depth on one axis, temperatures on another axis. I'm trying to get at this issue of metamorphism. Rocks being changed by higher heat and greater pressure. Now, there are certain things which we never see on Earth, and that's what this thing represents here. That is very low temperature at very great depth. We just don't see those kind of conditions. So there's a portion of this which doesn't relate. We don't see these kinds of conditions. Now let's look at metamorphism. There are different kinds of metamorphism. If you have rocks that have been formed previously, and into those rocks now is intruded some very hot material, like a granite magma, let's say, that's intruded into that rock. If you go up to the Porter Museum, you'll look at the diagram which shows those rocks kind of standing on edge there, and you'll see cutting across that is a big thing called a diorite. All right, that's a kind of an igneous rock. Okay, diorite, kind of an igneous rock of a certain composition. It was molten and it intruded into all those layered rocks, cut right across them. So it's younger than those layered rocks. That's how we know that. Cross-cutting relationships, it cut right across them. Okay. So that diorite was very hot when it did that. And so sometimes it has changed the country rock into which it's intruded, and you get what's called contact metamorphism. Now that change could be a reordering of the mineral grains that were there. It could be an actual conversion of those mineral grains into other mineral grains. Sometimes it makes like a glassy, fine-grained edge as if it melted and then cooled very quickly. There are all kinds of manifestations of contact metamorphism, but that would happen at very shallow depth, very high temperatures. You would get contact, kind of contact metamorphism. That's the idea of this diagram. At places where you get pretty high temperatures, but various levels of pressure, you can get low-grade metamorphism, medium-grade metamorphism, high-grade metamorphism. And you get what you get are different assemblages of minerals and different textures in the rock. Because a rock, when it's subjected to metamorphism, it may want to align, the minerals may want to align in response to the pressure that they're under. They may want to change their alignment and get their order kind of in a line with the pressure, called a directed pressure. Sometimes the minerals will actually change. They'll just simply be unstable anymore under those kind of pressures, and they'll kind of resorb a little bit. Different minerals will form that might be more stable in those things. Now remember now, you've got millions of years to accomplish this. So these changes are taking place at incredibly slow rates, but over incredibly long periods of time. So you can do this, or at least that's the idea. So when geologists are thinking about the rocks that they're looking at, when they go out walking along these trails and looking in these hills and looking at the different rocks, they, in the back of their minds, they have this kind of thing going on as they look at those rocks. Now, what we see around here, now we've got some examples. This is a great place to look for different rocks. All you got to do is walk down the road and start, well, walk up to the Porter Museum and just start picking up rocks. And what you'll find, and what you'll find, for example, you'll find a lot of rocks like this. This kind of salt and pepper looking look. And sometimes, by the way, if you get too small of a piece, you can't tell what it is. But basically, what we're looking at here are examples of the diorites that we find up in the mountains here that have cut across some of these. Most of the rocks around us are very old metamorphic rocks. They're what we call schists and gneisses, and I'll explain what those are in a minute. But cutting across those older metamorphic rocks are these somewhat younger intrusive rocks that are diorites. Now, it's sort of intermediate in composition between granites and basalts. Okay, so intermediate in composition. Why would we have that here? Well, it's not easy necessarily to understand. I don't know that I can explain why we would have a whole bunch of dioritic type of igneous rocks in here. But what it would suggest to me is that, let me see if I can get this at another way. Let's back up a second and go to very recent times, like the last 15 million years or so. And we look at the volcanoes that began to form as the North American plate overrode the Pacific plate. If you heard some of my talks on plate tectonics last week and stuff, some of this might make a little more sense. But what we see when we look at these volcanoes is that the if you look at the chemical composition of the magmas coming out of them, material coming out of them, it's andesitic in composition, kind of intermediate in composition. An andesite is just a very fine-grained version of a diorite. It just means it cooled a lot quicker than this did, than the diorite did. But the chemical composition is the same. Okay, so I'm kind of wondering if what we're seeing here is evidence of at the time of these diorites formed, which can be some of these go back to the Jurassic in age, which is about 140 million years. If we're not seeing an environment in which andesites or intermediate composition igneous rocks were not present, in other words, are we seeing some kind of evidence of a much, much, much older plate tectonic activity in this area? It's pretty clear that the mountains we're looking at here and their position and everything, the rocks that are in there probably represent very old time, going back hundreds of millions, over 100 million years in age. It probably represent at least one period of mountain building. Mountains build up, completely eroded down, and now thrust up into their new position. That these rocks are not the original rocks in these mountains, in effect. They were actually formed at a pre-existing time, a pre-existing mountain range, which we no longer have any evidence for beyond the rocks themselves now. So I don't want to get this too complicated or anything, and certainly I don't fully understand everything here, because this is new territory to me as well. But the idea is that we could begin to say something about the history of the area by piecing together then this kind of information. I want to show you one more thing, and I realize it's probably past time. I wasn't paying much attention to the time. But if you just look at this map here for a second, let me just hold this up. Geologists love to make maps, because what we try to do is show the distribution in space of these different rock units that we've gone out, let's say, and mapped all the rocks in the area, and we've noted what they look like, and we've said, oh yes, this is a diorite here, it's cross-cut by a basaltic dike here, or whatever. However we do that. And then we map the distribution of those rock units. And we give them different colors and stuff. And then we can begin to piece together the geologic history of the area. And that's what a geologic map attempts to do. But if you look at this, this is a map of the Holden area. Here's Holden right here. All this yellow stuff in here is very young sediment. Glacial sediment. Not hardening the rock at all, just sitting on top of everything else, covering everything up. The youngest stuff in here. But the rocks that make up the mountains here, like Copper Mountain or Buckskin Mountain, these rocks are very old. Probably 150 million years and older rock. May go back as much as, some people think as much as 350 million years in age. But they're most all of them are metamorphosed, and they're cross-cut by some of these more igneous rocks. And I'll just leave this out in case you're interested in taking a look at it and get a good feel for it. And then, if you're really interested, and you've got absolutely nothing better to do, you can try to match, for example, the pattern T, this pattern here, and the letters THG to what's over here. Now THG talks about what's called the Copper Peak and Holden Lake plutons. These are igneous rock masses, okay? And then you go and you look under THG in this description, and it describes the chemistry and the mineralogy of those rocks. So you can get a geologic map of an area you're interested in, and it pieces together the history of the area, it puts them in an order. What's the oldest is usually down at the bottom, and the youngest up at the top. And then it puts together, also includes a description of what those units are. So you can kind of get a feeling for the geologic history of the area by looking at the geologic map.
How do they make that map?
Okay, it's made on a... In a couple ways. I mean, it's made by primarily observation. Okay, you have to go out and you have to walk the ground. You have to look at the rock units. You are describing them, and you're measuring their attitude. By that I mean whether they've got a good attitude or a bad attitude.
No, Joe.
What you do is you measure the angle. You look at the bedding. If there's evidence of bedding in a rock, let's say it looks like this. You can measure this angle, which is like, let's say it's like a dip. Angle from the horizontal dipping into the earth. Okay? If you put this in three dimensions now, put this in three dimensions. You could, if it outcrops right here and outcrops right here, you could measure the compass direction between those two points, and that's giving you an idea of what's called the strike of the unit.
So there was a lot of people who went out with surveying stuff and walked around and did this whole area.
And,
not only this area, but
geologists will they'll study an area like this. It would obviously take a lot of time to do that, but different geologists will come into the area over time, look interested in different parts of the history here, and we'll publish what they find, and they'll gradually put this together. This represents an understanding of the geology of the area by a certain group of people at a certain point in time. A map is never, in one sense, a map is never done, because the next person coming along might look at it a little bit differently, bring a different kind of history to it, an understanding of it. And geology just advances. I mean, our understanding of different processes and different kinds of rocks and the origin of different kinds of rock changes over time. And so we would bring a different understanding to the same group of rock that we see there. So this represents the understanding of a geologic setting in here at a particular point in time. But you'd have to go out and look at those. You'd measure the strike and the dip of the rocks, the orientation of the rocks in space, and then you would gradually plot that on a map and begin to, almost in a sense, not quite this simple, but almost in a sense of connecting the dots kind of thing. It's not quite that rudimentary, but it's not too far from it. I mean, it's not like this is rocket science. You know, the way you're, it's really kind of a straightforward approach.
Mm-hmm. Would this be generally true of the entire Cascade Range?
Yeah, I mean, it depends on what you mean by the entire Cascade Range, but yeah, there is, the history of the Cascades seems to be a coherent history. Not to say that the rocks in the northern Cascades are the same as the rocks in the southern Cascades, or some differences in the history, but the Cascades is a fairly continuous evidence of mountain building at a particular points in time over a fairly large area.
And this is quite different from the Olympic Mountains,
yes,
which is almost exclusively basalt.
The Olympic Mountains are a real, now by the Olympic Mountains, now you tell me to correct my geology here, you're talking about the Olympic Peninsula?
Yes.
Okay. My understanding of that is that those rocks are very different and in fact probably represent rock which have been plastered onto the North American plate. Mm-hmm. When the plate was coming across, mm-hmm. the Pacific plate was coming down, mm-hmm. the Pacific plate was carrying the rocks which are a part of the Olympic Peninsula, and those rocks are now accreted onto the North American plate.
The ice scraper theory.
What?
The ice scraper theory?
The ice scraper theory? Yeah, right. Yeah. Well, I mean, that supposedly happened somewhere around 30 million years ago. And you had the Pacific plate coming underneath, you had what were called seamounts on that, and then those were essentially plastered up against the North American plate and accreted onto the North American plate. But why would that happen as opposed to just totally subduction? I don't know.
They were just real small plates that just kind of like the one in Los Angeles, kind of hit it and caught and just kind of dragged.
Yeah, in Los Angeles, if you look on the west side of the San Andreas Fault, there are pieces of the North American plate that got caught when the Pacific plate and North American plate came together, and those North American plate pieces are kind of sliding along the San Andreas Fault now, on the wrong side of the San Andreas Fault. They kind of got clopped off on that edge. It's interesting to think about these kinds of things because plate tectonics is one way to think about these things, which has really enabled us to integrate a lot of understanding of volcanoes and earthquakes and faulting and where minerals form and where these rock units form and why they're shaped the way they are. When you walk around here, look for rocks like those diorites I talked about. Look for rocks like this, which is a quartzite.
They're different. That's darker.
This
one
is so
place.
Clear to you what these are, but I was curious, these. To me, anything kind of speckled like that is granite, from being a kid. So how do you know from looking, how are you going to know what the mixtures are that form these without doing some kind of a lab analysis of what the minerals are.
You look at them under, like under a microscope.
Uh-huh.
All right. Minerals will have a particular color, shape, density, hardness, breakage pattern, what's called cleavage, and by looking at the minerals and putting together their properties, geologists can distinguish one mineral from another mineral.
Just by looking at them.
By looking at them. Mm-hmm. Now, that's not to say that it's always obvious. It's not always obvious. You need to be able to have mineral grains that are big enough that you can see those different kinds of things in them. So and when they're not big enough, then you can use like a hand lens like this, and which kind of magnifies it about 10 times. And sometimes you can see it a little bit easier. Sometimes that's not enough. Geologists will also, as you probably know, if you cut a rock extremely thin, on the order of a few thousandths of an inch in thickness, light will pass through it. Different minerals will affect the passage of light through that rock differently. And therefore, when you look under a microscope that's designed to do that, they'll have different colors and other different kinds of characteristics which help you identify what the mineral is you're looking at, even though it's very, very thin. And then you put those mineral assemblages together, and that helps you then identify what the rock is.
See, this rock is two different colors.
Well, no, this rock, I mean, it does have different colors, but it's essentially the same mineral. This is, I believe, this is the an example of the, well, there are some, this is an example of a quartzite, but there's also some other dark grains in it as well, so this may just simply be a real quartz-rich phase, but I don't know if I have something important about it. Some of the rocks you'll look at will have, you can see kind of a, this is not a layering, but this is a metamorphic effect where minerals have been kind of streaked out, and then they kind of oriented themselves into layers and are kind of laying flat and creates almost like as if it was a sedimentary rock.
Yeah. No, but it's not.
It's not a sedimentary rock. It's actually a metamorphic rock.
And it stratified because of the, when it cooled at different rates, is that?
Well, the reason it's stratified is because the different minerals have aligned themselves with respect to the pressure, the pressure that rock was subjected to. The pressure on a rock, you got minerals at all kinds of angles, let's say, and it's subjected to pressure like that. What these minerals will tend to do is to line up across that pressure. They will actually part, be resorbed and then reform and kind of reorient themselves across that pressure, and then you'll get that kind of a phenomenon. Sometimes the metamorphism, a very high metamorphism, you'll get an actual banding where minerals will tend to group together, and you'll get dark minerals, and then you'll get kind of light minerals, and then dark minerals and light minerals, and you'll see banded rocks all around here. If you go out and look for them, you'll find banded rocks. And those are what are called gneisses.
Would it be more appropriate for us lay people, would it be an oversimplification to think crystal instead of mineral? Because you're talking about direction, you're talking about...
Sure. I mean, the crystal form, the crystals themselves, or the minerals, you're right. That's probably maybe an easier way to think about it. Some of the crystals are flattish crystals, and those flattish crystals will orient themselves relative to that pressure field. You're right. That's probably an easier way to say it. And so when you get this under very high metamorphic conditions, you'll get actual gneisses, which is spelled G-N-E-I-S-S, pronounced gneiss. And that's a very high-grade metamorphic rock in which you've had partial melting and very high temperatures and pressure. You have partial melting and you realign them both going on, and a separation of,
minerals that want to be together versus minerals, other minerals that want to be together. And you're going to have a movement of minerals apart in association with other minerals the same way.
So this would be a nice,
right? Yes. And this is starting towards, yeah, this would be like I think this is what's called a hornblende gneiss that we have up in the Buskin Mountain area. Again, take a look at the Florida Museum. They have the rocks kind of laid out there and identified. It kind of helps get a picture of what they look like.
Gold.
I think this is what we call a muscovite schist. It has a lot of muscovite and quartz in it. And it's been subjected to a reasonably high temperature and pressure with what we might call a more medium grade metamorphic rock. And the chemistry is, it has a kind of a layering look to it, and that's called a schistosity. And because the muscovite is kind of a flattish mineral grain, it'll kind of orient itself a little bit relative to these pressures. What you don't get with a schist that you get with a gneiss, in gneiss you get the minerals actually segregating out and light, like you get that dark and light banding.
Yeah.
Here you get the minerals kind of oriented themselves, but they're not really separating one type of mineral from another type of mineral. They're just orienting relative to the pressure, and so they call these a schist.
What about this color, this kind of light tan?
The color is typical of the mineral muscovite.
Muscovite,
yeah.
Okay.
That mica.
When I see that color, okay.
Yeah. Now, there are all kinds of things that can give you that color. When you go up to the portal, take a look at different kinds of things. Like when you see a rock which has a lot of iron in it, and that iron oxidizes, sometimes you get the same kinds of color.
Exactly, yeah.
I've had people, biotite. When the mineral biotite weathers, it'll look like gold.
Ooh.
I can't tell you how many times I've had people say, I think I've got gold.
Is that what they call fool's gold?
No, fool's gold is an iron sulfide. It's a pyrite, an actual sulfide. And there's a lot of pyrite associated with the minerals up here in the mountain, Copper Mountain. But it's funny that that biotite, when it weathers, will get a goldish look to it. It's just kind of a weathering phenomenon with it. And people have looked at that and said, oh, this must be gold. And it's not. It's really just weathered biotite. So you got to be careful. But fool's gold is actual iron sulfide.
The yellow color of the tailings comes from?
Probably from the oxidation of iron and the weathering of the pyrite and... predominantly, it's from the processing and the weathering of iron-rich material.
Does it underneath? Is it that color? I mean, all the way down.
Well, it'll be somewhat different, but
it'll be pretty much.
I think very much different.
Think of northern Minnesota and the tailings up there. You know, that's a very
iron
reddish.
We're reddish because of all the iron content there. This is a reduced iron. Not an oxidized iron so much, as most of that is a kind of a reduced iron. Well, there's a lot of hematite, though. I'm sorry, there's a lot of hematite in those ores in Minnesota. So a lot of that is a ferric iron or an oxidized iron. So that would be more of an oxidized iron in that case.
So most of the mountains out here are caused by the tectonic... activity, and then it was more recent that we got the volcanic activity for St. Helens.
A geologist would say that any of this stuff is related to plate tectonics. If plate tectonics works, then all of this is somehow related to the movement of plates. Now, these may not be the plates we see today. They may be plates that we've seen that have been around other times. But what we're seeing today is probably related to, let's say the last 50 million years or so of plate movement, of North American plate and Pacific plate colliding. Mm-hmm. About 30 million years ago, the Olympic Peninsula kind of being accreted onto the North American plate, uplift going on here, these mountains being raised up. We've got some 15 million year, 20 million year old plutons or igneous rock masses that have intruded this material, indicating that at about that time we were having a great deal of mountain building going on. We also have evidence that that of course may be what raised the mountains, but their present configuration is in large part due to glaciation, where the glaciers have in a sense eroded out these valleys, made them more sharp, more young looking peaks even than they were then when they were just simply being eroded by water. So it's a combination of things.
So when did the volcanoes come along, St. Helens and Rainier and all of that?
Glacier Peak, for example, the most recent evidence we have of volcanic activity at Glacier Peak is about 6,000 years ago.
Oh, okay.
And that's related to this piece of pumice right there, which is a piece of Glacier Peak pumice.
So that was found here. That pumice is from here.
Yes, right. Okay. From Glacier Peak. It was collected in this area. Mm-hmm. Been dated at around 6,000 years ago. Mm-hmm. The volcanic activity around here is that's fairly old volcanic activity for this area. A lot of the volcanic activity around here has been obviously as recent as Mount St. Helens and what's going on at Mount Rainier and one thing or another. But
in terms of what actually caused those peaks, weren't they predominantly caused by volcanic activity?
Yes.
Okay, that's what I thought.
And those are
original.
The magmas associated with those tend to be andesitic in composition. Uh-huh. It's why they're so explosive.
Okay.
They have a lot of gas associated with them, and they tend to be very explosive, as opposed to like the Hawaiian volcanoes, which are more basaltic. Mm-hmm. And so when they erupt, they tend to more flow.
Material
tends to flow out more. You get broad volcanoes, what are called shield volcanoes, as opposed to these volcanoes are more considered to be composite volcanoes.
What's Iceland?
Iceland?
The volcano.
Iceland is sitting right on a mid-oceanic ridge.
Mm.
And so the volcanic activity in Iceland tends to be more basaltic, coming basically out of the mid-oceanic ridge, directly right on top of it. Mm. A lot of geothermal energy, geothermal hot springs and that kind of thing associated with that environment too.
What about the black glassy rock?
It's obsidian.
It's obsidian. And how does that
work? When you see glassy material, what it basically suggests is very rapid cooling. Mm-hmm. And I certainly don't know enough about obsidian to say anything of any definitive nature about it, but it would suggest to me that you had molten material that was able to cool extremely rapidly. Mm-hmm. Why you don't see more obsidian than we do, I'm not sure. I really don't know, but
you'll see a lot.
When you do have very rapid cooling, you get that glass because it doesn't have time to form crystals.
Central Oregon.
Just like Oregon.
That's where I had seen
a lot in Central Oregon.
Newberry Mountain is all obsidian.
Yeah,
that's where I had seen it.
What have you heard about the origin of that? Is that
obsidian? It's the real fast cooling.
Real fast cooling.
Yeah,
you don't have time to get the crystals formed.
Right, that's why it's.
Glass. Any theories on why it cooled so fast?
I don't know.
Yeah. If you've been down to Central Oregon, that you're like walking on the moon. It's just all the lava is just right there at the top.
Right, we had done that.
I remember. Years ago, we did.
Right.
Yeah. It's a lot of ash and obsidian.
There's pumice too.
There was pumice. I remember seeing it.
Had that big shield, like a shield volcano. It just opened up the ground over in Pullman in that area and took like 11 feet or 28 feet about 6 or 7 times and went clear to the ocean. Just it could go in 28 days. If you were on foot, everything was just devoured. And it's really, really thick. That's why you get the big basalt floats.
Big basalt floats. Yeah.
Out here. And we had a lot
but you
of
don't have volcanoes. You have big rifts, and then out of those rifts it comes.
Yeah, the rifts.
Those are somewhere in the 15 to 20 million years in age.
And this area has a lot of it. And then you had the volcanoes.
Ooh, that's pretty. It's about Miocene.
Miocene.